Number 13-5223 et al. Shakir Abdurrahim Amir, detainee, Camp Delta, and Saeed Amir Sadiq, next friend of Shakir Abdurrahim Amir, appellants versus Barack Obama, President of the United States of America et al. Mr. Eisenberg for the appellants, Mr. Lennitz for the appellees.
Good morning, and may it please the court, John Eisenberg for the appellants. Thank you. I'd like to focus today on the question of jurisdiction and start by discussing the four cases that the court has cited in its order of October 9th, and I would like to explain how they relate to the jurisdictional arguments that we've made on appeal. Collectively, these cases stand for four propositions. First, habeas corpus lies to challenge conditions of confinement that vitiate the justification for confinement. That's a quote from Creek versus Stone, or that are so extreme as to transgress constitutional prohibitions.
That's a quote. Which case uses that?
The latter is Miller versus Overhauser, 1953, Judge Prettyman. So extreme as to transgress constitutional prohibitions. Habeas is available. I'm sorry, would you... That would be 206 F. Fed Second at 419. Here's the full quote. Except in circumstances so extreme as to transgress constitutional prohibitions, the courts will not interfere with discipline or treatment in a place of legal confinement, and so habeas corpus is not an available remedy. Keep in mind the first clause in that sentence, except in circumstances so extreme as to transgress constitutional prohibitions.
What's your response to the government's argument in its 28J letter that these cases focus on confinement, place of confinement, not treatment?
I think that is true only for two of the cases, and in those two cases, place of confinement just happened to be what is at issue. Creek versus Miller's involved a question regarding place of confinement, but the court said, this is a quote, 379 F. Second at 109, in general, habeas corpus is available to an applicant to protest his confinement in a certain place or under certain conditions that he claims vitiate the justification for confinement. Miller, the other case that people have cited, that the government has cited, 206 F. Second at 420, says that on habeas, the district judge may direct transfer to another institution, that's the place element, or, quote, that the prisoner's retained civil rights be respected. That's not about place, that's about civil rights. The court can order via injunction the government to adhere to civil rights requirements.
Do you have any holding that goes beyond the vitiate the justification for confinement principle?
I would say the other two cases actually cited in the court's letter had nothing to do with place. Hudson versus Hardy was not a challenge to the place of detention. That was a challenge
to... The court didn't have jurisdiction there, as it noted.
But that's true, but the problem was mootness.
The steel company, the court would never have reached... anything like that, right?
I believe that's true.
It's all dicta.
It's all, yes, I believe so. I believe certainly the conditions of confinement language in Creek and Miller is dictum to the extent that what was at issue in those cases was place of confinement. I don't think the same thing could be said of the most recent case, U.S. versus Wilson. It said very plainly.
Why do you concede that it was only place of confinement in Creek? I mean, in terms of the remedy, the psychiatric services that the juvenile was seeking could have been provided either in a different facility or in the one he was in, couldn't it?
Yes, that would be in Creek.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Is that right? So why is it? Why are you conceding that it's limited to place of confinement? Or are you not doing that?
I'm really not doing that.
I see.
I'm that was the focus of some of the language in Creek, but it addressed both situations. It said very specifically that it's available as to an applicant to protest his confinement in a certain place or under certain conditions. So transfer to another facility wasn't necessarily what this was all about. These cases are all about providing mental care, medical care that is essential.
But the court's premise in all of them is that the confinement itself would be unlawful.
Yes.
In the absence of that.
Yes.
So anyway, it's a standard application of habeas.
Right. What we're talking about right now is purely jurisdiction. We allege there are unlawful conditions of confinement. There are unlawful restraints occurring. There's an unlawful restraint on the right of religious free exercise, as well as an unlawful restraint on fundamental civil liberty. The question the threshold question today is, does this court have habeas jurisdiction to address allegations of unlawful terms of detention? I believe the answer is yes. The actual unlawfulness, that's a different story. In the 15 minutes I have available today, I thought I would focus on jurisdiction because that really is a thorniest issue.
Well, unless,
go ahead.
Did you have another jurisdictional question?
Yes. So I helped me to understand. I was a bit puzzled by your jurisdictional argument, and maybe I'm just misunderstanding. In Kiemba 2, in footnote 2 of Kiemba 2, we said that Boumediene restored the status quo ante and put the detainees back under statutory habeas. Isn't that what we said? In your argument, as I understand it, was trying to make these distinctions between core habeas and ancillary habeas. Well, we rejected that. Isn't there a stronger argument than the one that you've made? Based on what we did in Kiemba 2. That argument would be, after Kiemba 2, the detainees at Guantanamo their claims should be measured under statutory habeas. And then that's why this line of cases becomes relevant, right? Statutory habeas in the D.C. Circuit, it appears as if conditions of confinement may be part of statutory habeas, but that's not an argument.
I did not distinguish between statutory and constitutional habeas in my briefs because I don't believe Boumediene did.
No. But in Kiemba 2, we said the result of Boumediene is that that the detainees at Guantanamo are under statutory habeas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe I'm missing that.
I'll accept that, certainly. My point was that whether statutory or constitutional, our claim under either provenance,
Do you have cases that tell us that under constitutional habeas, a challenge to conditions of confinement is part of habeas? You do have statutory cases that show that. Why in the world would you be making? I just didn't understand that.
I'll grasp.
Let me turn your attention, if I could, to jurisdiction, to the merits. To the merits.
Yes.
Yeah. And I have two questions. The first is that, as I understand your theory, it's that forced feeding makes the detention indefinite, right? That's your theory.
Correct. One of my theories is that force feeding perpetuates indefinite detention, yes.
Perpetuates indefinite? I'm not sure I know what that means.
Well, what I mean is they're keeping them alive under conditions in which they're not being brought to trial or military proceeding. Their detention at this point is indefinite.
Let me ask you the question this way.
Yes.
This circuit has repeatedly held that under the authorization for the use of military force, properly detained individuals can be detained during the pendency of the hostilities. In other words, this circuit has held essentially that quote, indefinite detention, at least for the time being, is lawful.
Mm-hmm.
So how then, given those cases, how does your force feeding theory fit into that?
Well, ultimately, my force feeding.
You see my point?
Yes, I do. I do. But ultimately, and this is an argument that evolved over the course of the litigation, but in its final incarnation, the argument has become that there is no, the force feeding does not bear a legitimate penological relationship to a legitimate penological interest.
Okay, so that's your Turner argument.
Yes, that's okay, my
so
Turner argument. Ultimately, that's what we're relying on.
Okay. All right, so then you brought me to my second question. What is your best answer to the government's major so-called legitimate penological interest, namely maintaining order and security, in its citation of a whole series of federal and state court cases, accepting that as a legitimate peniological interest under Turner? What's your best answer to that?
My best answer to that is what has happened in California, the response of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to the hunger strike in the California prisons.
Okay, but isn't it true that those cases arose under California law, where there's a constitutional right to die, right?
No, actually, I don't believe so.
I thought you were using that as an argument that there was a less restrictive alternative.
Yes.
That assumes that
doctrine
applies under Turner.
If I may, there is no constitutional right to die under California law. There is a constitutional right to refuse medical treatment.
California Supreme Court has not ruled that prisoners have a constitutional right to die?
To refuse medical treatment. That's the Thor case.
Correct?
That's the Thor case.
What?
The Cruzan in the U.S. Supreme Court.
I'm not talking about Cruzan. I'm talking about California law.
Right. California law, I believe, is just as in Cruzan, it said there is a right to refuse medical treatment, and prisoners have that right.
Uh-huh.
Now, ultimately, that could lead to death, but it's not a right to commit suicide. It's never been cast in that way in California, and it's certainly not in the U.S. Supreme Court.
So what about all these circuit court and state court decisions that accept the government's proffered rationale? What, are they just all wrong?
No, I don't think that they considered the alternative. Is there an alternative, which is what Turner versus Safley and Washington versus Harper say.
And what's the alternative here?
The alternative here is I believe the Guantanamo Bay authorities have jumped the gun. They are force-feeding these men before their lives are at risk. They're force-feeding these men really not...
Aren't they using protocols established by the Bureau of Prisons and used throughout the federal prison
system?
They
say that they are, but if you compare them with what the California authorities have done, the California authorities have said, is that hunger strike is over. They said, in agreement with the prisoners themselves, we will not force-feed...
These are California state authorities,
yes,
right?
Yes. State courts. But I believe
my question is about, it was my understanding that at Guantanamo they're using the protocols used in the United States
Bureau of Prisons. Yes,
right?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's what they say they are doing, yes. But I believe in that within the, when they
so
are...
Why is it an answer to that question that they're doing something differently in California?
Because California is a less restrictive means of achieving the same thing, the need to maintain prison security. The hunger strike, it's...
So is your challenge, to the protocols of the Bureau of Prisons?
Yes, my challenge is that the... No. My challenge is that in the... Well, I can't speak to what happens in a supermax prison in the United States. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about that. I don't know how those prisons are run. I don't understand those conditions. I do understand Guantanamo.
And you're just making a Turner argument.
A Turner argument about Guantanamo is what I'm making.
Okay,
just a Turner argument and just about Guantanamo.
All right, but you said something that made me realize maybe I misread your brief or don't understand your theory. In response to my question, you said your complaint is that they are force-feeding detainees prematurely. Is that what I heard you say? That is, they're force-feeding them before they face the serious risk of death?
What I'm saying is that a reasonable alternative would not be to not force-feed them until their lives are, they're at risk of death or permanent organ injury.
And then what? And then force-feed them?
That's a good question. Well, hopefully it wouldn't come to that point.
No, serious. Did you make that argument in your... I just didn't understand. That's a totally different theory than I thought you were bringing here. I thought your argument was that forced feeding under these circumstances is unconstitutional.
Yes.
Not that it's premature.
Yes.
So which is it?
Okay. I have a peculiar problem here. I'm asking a court, and now a court of three judges, to authorize something that may result in deaths. That's a difficult thing to ask for. My belief is that force feeding in and of itself is unconstitutional in these circumstances. If the court were to look for some sort of middle ground, I would be okay with that. And I offer the middle ground of their force feeding too soon. But ultimately, my belief is that force feeding is unethical, it's inhumane, it's a violation of international law and a violation of medical ethics.
But you see, under Turner,
yes,
the analysis is, we can assume you're right that force feeding is unconstitutional. Turner then asks the next question, which is, given that there's a constitutional right, does the prison nevertheless have a legitimate peniological interest, that's the words from Turner, to restrict that constitutional right? So
yes.
Are telling us that there's a constitutional right not to be forced, that doesn't answer the Turner issue, right?
Yes. The question is it essential to force feed to maintain prison security, I believe.
Yeah.
And my answer is I don't believe it is essential to force feed this quickly, certainly.
Okay, is there any evidence, just one more question, is there any evidence in the record about the arguments you're making regarding prematurity of force feeding?
No, and that's much of the problem. I never got a hearing on this case. What we got from both judges was a determination that they had no jurisdiction. I don't believe we really should be reaching a final disposition on the merits in these cases because we haven't had a full chance to litigate them yet. These cases ended with a finding of no jurisdiction.
Well, I don't think you have the only issue before us here is a preliminary injunction, right?
Yes.
Okay. Steve, I'm sorry.
Turner explicitly rejected a least restrictive alternative analysis.
Yeah.
In the face of that, you're asking that the court monitor the exact moment when the risk of death reaches such a point that it's okay for the prison authorities to introduce force feeding?
What Turner said was the court should consider the absence of ready alternatives. It's not a least restrictive means test. It's a ready alternatives test. And my argument is that there are ready alternatives to these regulations.
As I understand, the line you're drawing between what was agreed on in California and what the Bureau of Prisons is doing is simply a question of exactly how close to death the prisoners have brought themselves. And I guess that seems an astonishing judgment to put on the courts.
I think it's equal. I think it would be equally astonishing and disturbing for a court to approve a practice that is internationally viewed to be unethical and amounting to torture.
You aren't saying, are you, that the prisoners have not engaged in conduct which, pursued further, leads to death, right? That's a given.
If they continue to not eat indefinitely, they will eventually die.
And my recollection is that the record has some data on weight loss and things like that. Am I wrong on that?
As to these four individuals, yes.
Yeah.
If they reach less than 85% of ideal body weight, or not just that, even if they miss 9 consecutive meals and are still overweight, that's a hunger striker. Who may be force-fed, even if they have high blood pressure but are otherwise healthy, as am I. I would be a candidate for force feeding under these protocols.
Because well, I have my blood pressure. It's more than that. It's not just that. I mean, there's also, they look at intent and there are other indicia, right? It's not simply anyone who misses 9 meals.
That's all it takes. That's one of the four.
Well, that shows that there's an intent to engage in a hunger strike as well. Am I wrong?
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. I'm on hunger strike. I weigh 180 okay. pounds. I have high blood pressure. I'm not eating today. That makes me a candidate.
Mm-hmm. What? I want to take you back to these cases that the government cites. I'm just curious about what your response is to them. For example, there's this New York Court of Appeals case where the court says, quote, there is a virtually universal recognition among appellate courts that an inmate hunger strike can have a significant destabilizing effect on the institution. And then they cite a number of cases, including this one involving the killer of John Lennon. And the court actually makes findings here that the hunger strike that this inmate undertook actually caused serious disruption in the prison. So I guess my question is, what about those cases, and what sort of evidence would you produce at trial to counter that, to question the legitimacy of that kind of reason?
Well, now, how would I produce evidence that things are going smoothly at Guantanamo Bay and these prisoners are not threatening prison security through the hunger strike? I have no access to anything at Guantanamo Bay. I alleged at one point they were being given Reglan involuntarily, a drug with potentially serious side effects. Mm-hmm. The government denied it. We've abandoned that argument because we have no way of proving it.
What about these
that
cases?
Is a really good question. How do I prove what's going on at Guantanamo
well,
Bay? I have no
cases?
Idea.
What about these cases that I just mentioned? It's New York. It's New York. And there's a whole series of federal circuit court cases
yes.
that say the same thing.
All litigated within the context of a litigation process in which you get discovery. I will not get discovery of what's going on at Guantanamo Bay. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. We have trouble even communicating with our clients.
Okay. You have anything else? Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Daniel Lenners for the Appellees. I'll start with a minor point, but one that follows on the previous discussion. Petitioner's counsel misunderstands the nature of the hunger strike protocols at issue in Guantanamo Bay. The declaration in the record from the medical personnel at Guantanamo Bay makes clear that things such as missing 9 meals in a row or a detainee's body mass index simply make that detainee eligible for enteral feeding. Whether or not a detainee receives any given enteral feeding is measured on a feeding-by-feeding basis by medical personnel and is only done when necessary to preserve the detainee's life or health. That's made clear at appendix page 94, paragraph 11 of the declaration. Says even after the commander authorizes the use of enteral feeding for that detainee, the detainee is always offered the opportunity to eat a standard meal or consume the liquid supplement orally instead of being enterally fed. If the detainee continues to refuse to eat or consume the liquid supplement orally, medical personnel will only implement enteral feeding when it becomes medically necessary to preserve a detainee's life and health. I don't think this is a particularly crucial point, but it does make clear that detainees are only entirely fed when to preserve
their life or health. Is there any way for petitioners to challenge the judgment of the authorities at Guantanamo that the hunger strike is not having a deleterious effect on detainee morale or something? I mean, he points out this is a unique situation, right?
Your Honor, the SAFLE standards and incredibly deferential one. The regulations need only be reasonably related to a legitimate governmental interest, and courts have made clear.
So does the government always prevail on that simply by invoking that interest, simply by saying you know, it's obvious to us that hunger strikes have a corrosive effect on detainee morale or whatever the criteria is, and there's no opportunity to challenge that?
Well, Your Honor,
is that your trump card? As long as you use that, that's the end of the inquiry?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has made clear in Overton that courts must accord substantial deference to the professional judgment of prison administrators.
Are all cases in which there's some way for the courts or litigants to find out what's going on in the prison. As your opponent has pointed out, that's different here. Guantanamo is a different sort of prison facility than any of these other cases we're looking at, correct? That's
right, Your Honor. It's a facility in which even more deference should be accorded given the nature of the detainees and the nature of the facility.
But do we accord that deference simply upon the invocation of the authority, or is there some way for us to test the accuracy of the authority statement?
Courts have tested the accuracy, tested whether it's reasonably related to a legitimate governmental interest by looking for an obvious other method of attaining the same interest. Those are the cases quoted by petitioner, that if there's some obvious way for the government to achieve the same interest, then the courts will suggest that the regulation at issue is not rationally related to a legitimate governmental interest. Petitioners do not challenge the government's legitimate interest in prison security and safety. Right. What they say is that entirely feeding hunger-striking detainees is not rationally related to that interest. And clearly it is. Courts have accepted that proposition across the board. The Guantanamo has made the judgment that it's necessary for prison security. And this is a situation in which substantial deference.
So there's no substantial argument that Guantanamo is so differently situated than other prisons that maybe there ought to be some inquiry into whether there's a penological interest here that's legitimate?
I think if the Guantanamo Bay facility is different, it's different in ways that inure to the government's benefit. It's a military facility. It's not a traditional prison.
Except it's subject to habeas corpus.
That's subject to habeas corpus, right. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And these are law of war detainees. They are not traditional prisoners.
Who have habeas corpus rights.
Who have habeas corpus rights under Boumediene. Right. And if Your Honor's turning me to the jurisdictional.
Yeah, let's talk about jurisdiction. Let me just focus your attention, if I could, on your, as I understand from your 28J letter, your argument about why Creek isn't controlling here is that it's a case of just confinement. Is that right? Not treatment.
I think all four of the cases that the court brought to the litigant's attention in its order.
Let me ask you about some of the language, okay? Creek says, its own language says, habeas corpus is available to an applicant who protests his confinement in a certain place or under certain conditions that he claims vitiate the justification. That's what Creek says. And Wilson, which is our other case on this, Wilson doesn't even mention place of confinement. It talks about treatment, and it cites a Sixth Circuit case, which is a case that is completely a conditions case. The prisoner was being beaten by other prisoners and guards. So I don't see the basis for limiting our case law to just the place of confinement.
So, Your Honor, if I might start with Creek.
Yeah, go ahead.
The court says under certain conditions that he claims vitiate the justification for confinement,
right,
that eliminate the justification for confinement,
right,
so that the remedy would be no confinement.
No, the remedy might be providing the service in the facility.
And then, Your Honor,
at
page 110, the court says the inquiry whether the juvenile is validly in the receiving home may entail the issue whether he may lawfully be detained there under conditions that are violative of the statute. The court saw the remedy not as one changing the conditions, but as a remedy as whether the place of confinement is legal.
Well, we don't know that because there was no remedy in the case. I mean, the remedy could have been either an order to transfer the juvenile to a facility where he could get the psychiatric services, or it could have been an order to provide the services in the current facility. We just don't know. The court never got that far.
Well,
but Wilson cites a case that's a clear treatment case where the person was being beaten by guards and other prisoners.
If Your Honor doesn't mind, I'll stick with Creek for a second.
Sure.
All of the examples the court gives on page 110 are examples of transferring to a different custody. Suppose the child were taken seriously ill and required an oxygen tent not available at the receiving home. It would not be seriously supposed that jurisdiction is lacking in the juvenile court to permit detention in an appropriate hospital. And it goes on to list other examples of detention in a different place. I would also point out, Your Honor, that the footnote, the court, footnote 4, the cases cited therein are all cases that talk about the place of confinement. So Lake v. Cameron, the first case cited, says habeas corpus challenges not only the fact of confinement, but also the place of confinement. Mm-hmm. Benton versus Reed, the second case cited, says habeas corpus is available to him to test the place of detention. Miller v. Olverhauser, the third case cited, says, the courts will not interfere with discipline or treatment in a place of legal confinement. The legal validity of confinement in a certain place is a different problem.
You know, your cite to Miller is interesting. Both in your brief and your Rule 28J letter, you cite Miller as stating, quote, courts will not interfere with discipline or treatment in a place of legal confinement, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But in both places, you leave off, quote, except in circumstances so extreme as to amount to a constitutional violation, courts will not. I
think that's fairly read as dicta, both in the context of Miller, which dealt with the legal place of confinement, and within the specific...
Of course it's dicta, but you did leave the key part of it out, and that doesn't make any distinction between confinement and treatment, nor does Wilson.
Well, and as for Wilson, Your Honor...
Yeah, what about Wilson?
So...
It says... Quote, conditions of confinement.
And in that case...
cites this coffin case from the Sixth Circuit.
And in that case...
And adds the phrase, unquestionably, has the right to challenge the conditions of his confinement through habeas.
In Wilson, Your Honor, the petitioner was challenging whether he was in a prison versus a mental hospital. He was challenging the place of his confinement. And I understand that the courts have used conditions of confinement broadly, but they are described to challenge the place of confinement. None of these cases deal with a court order that would have changed the conditions at which a person was confined. They all dealt with petitioners seeking a different place of confinement.
See, let's go back to basics for a minute. And I guess we could argue endlessly about what these words and these opinions mean. But going back to sort of the fundamentals here, explain to me why it makes a difference. Isn't the core question the same whether we look at this as confinement or treatment? Isn't the core question whether the condition that's complained of in the prison is unconstitutional? That's the question, whether that treatment or lack of it or condition is unconstitutional. Then you get to the remedy. And maybe the remedy would be to provide it in the institution or move the person out. But isn't the antecedent constitutional question always whether or not the treatment is unconstitutional?
I agree that that's the antecedent question, but I do not agree that habeas allows courts to give the remedy of changing the conditions of confinement in a certain place. The habeas remedy has traditionally been limited to one of freeing the person from the fact of confinement of reducing the
itself,
time of confinement.
The Supreme Court in Boumediene and Prieger both said that question's unresolved. They said it very clearly. Keep saying it's traditionally, but that is not what the Supreme Court said in this case.
The Supreme Court has left it an open
question.
It's
left it an open question. That's my whole point.
And we have
circuit law which suggests that it does cover treatment as well as treatment and conditions. And with the Supreme Court leaving the issue open and giving Creek and Wilson, Is that issue at least here been resolved?
I don't agree that it's been resolved, because I don't agree that this court's cases are binding precedent for the proposition that a prisoner may challenge the conditions of his confinement via the writ of habeas corpus. We cited numerous cases, both predating Bivens and more recently, that have said that habeas is not an appropriate vehicle to challenge a prisoner's conditions of confinement. Were this court to rule that detainees at Guantanamo Bay are allowed to challenge the conditions of their confinement, it would create a new law, and it would allow numerous challenges that are currently prohibited by 2241E2 and by traditional notions of the scope of the writ of habeas corpus.
Of course they're prohibited by E2, but this isn't an E2 case.
I think E2...
This is an E1 case. This is a habeas case, E2.
It's not a proper habeas case, Your Honor, which is why it's
we'll
an E2 case.
But this is not an E2 case. You don't, E2 cases don't help you. You haven't brought this under E2.
Your Honor, the district courts in this jurisdiction have...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you can go back to that. Do you disagree with my reading of Boudin and Prieger that they have left this very specific issue open?
I agree, Your Honor, that Prizer, Bellevue-Wolfish, and Boumediene all said that they are not addressing the scope of it with regard to conditions.
So that question's open?
With regard to Supreme Court precedent, Your Honor, yes.
Right. Okay.
If the court has no further questions.
Do you... I just want to make sure I completely understand the government's argument. Your argument is that, yes, the court has left the issue open. This circuit's case law is all limited to confinement, correct?
The place or fact of confinement, yes, Your Honor.
So the government's theory is that for us to assert habeas jurisdiction here, we would be extending our case law beyond what it currently is, right?
Extending your case law in conflict with the virtually unanimous decisions of the other courts of appeals that have said that habeas is not an appropriate vehicle.
I know about the Seventh Circuit cases, but the Second, the Ninth, and the Sixth all seem to agree with this circuit.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think the cases cited by Petitioner from the Sixth and Ninth Circuit can be understood as challenges to the sentence itself, to the fact of confinement, and aren't true conditions cases.
Okay, if we were to disagree with you about your reading of our cases, if we were to conclude that they stand for the proposition that habeas court has jurisdiction over either the place of confinement, the place or duration of confinement, or treatment, then do you have another argument about it? Or is...
We believe that E2 still bars these claims. I know Your Honor has suggested that you doubt that proposition, but Congress's clear intent was to prohibit Guantanamo detainees from challenging the conditions of their confinement. The floor statements that we quoted in our brief were that said that the congressional intent is to...
But Boudin also said congressional intent was to strip of habeas, and that was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So we're right back to the issue of what is habeas, right? And you, I don't think you've talked about Kiemba 2 either. In Kiemba 2, we said we're under statutory habeas. It's just... We said that. Now, I've dissented from that, but that's what we said. So we're looking at this as statutory habeas, right? That's what we're bound to do because of Kiemba 2.
And as we've argued, statutory habeas doesn't extend to these challenges, Your Honor.
Gotcha.
Anything else?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does Mr. Eisenberg have any time left? Okay. You could take 2 minutes. If you like.
I would, thank you. Just briefly, I would like to address Judge Griffith's question, how do we test the accuracy of the government's claim that these regulations are reasonably related to legitimate penological interests, given the unique circumstances at Guantanamo Bay? I do have one suggestion, and that would be, first, to put the burden on the government to make this showing. And second, permit them to make that showing under secure conditions in classified filings to which the attorneys who had been cleared could have access.
What would they have to show? that you doubt. So you're not trusting. You don't want to defer to their statement right now that which is, I take it, sort of common sense that hunger strikes are disruptive to in prison settings.
Well, for example, you want
to be able to show that that's not the case.
For example, they might claim that there are one or two prisoners who are leading the hunger strike and forcing others to participate. They have not made that claim, but that claim was made in California. That was a concern in California. That is one way that I could envision them attempting to show that force feeding is essential to maintain prison security. If they were to try to make that claim, I would try to rebut it with evidence that these prisoners are hunger striking completely voluntarily, which they have already asserted in their declarations. Now, I would expect the government to want to do that if they were willing to do it at all under secure conditions. All of us on this legal team have secret security clearance. I personally have top secret SCI security clearance from prior litigation. We could be trusted to litigate these issues in confidence. That would be one way of going about and litigating this.
At least the New York case said it was unnecessary to offer testimony as to the particular institution involved because the pattern essentially was the same. One could rely on statutes and other materials. So I don't see that Guantanamo-specific evidence would at all be required.
I think Guantanamo is really unique. It's unique in the history of this country, and generalizations do not help us much when it comes to dealing with Guantanamo Bay issues. And finally, I would also just like to remind the court, we do have another issue here. It's denial of the right to religious freedom, specifically the right to pray in congregation. I personally believe that's just as important an issue as the force feeding issue, and I have not seen any reasonable government response to our assertions procedurally and on the merits.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Case is submitted. Thank you both.